Hi, Marty Hart Landsberg. Welcome to KBOO.
Thanks, Bill. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
Martin Hart Landsberg is a teacher, writer, activist. He directed the political economy program at Lewis and Clark College for more than 20 of his 38 years that he spent teaching there. He's written a slew of books, including Capitalist Globalization, Consequences, Resistance, and Alternatives. He does alternatives in all of his books. He's also written on China and socialism, market reforms, and class struggles, the title of that book. He's very active in Portland. He served on the executive board of Jobs with Justice. He's on the workers' rights board of Jobs with Justice. And he's a leader of the organization Portland Rising. Finally, his blog on the economic front is a treasure of economic thought that's won thousands of regular readers, most not economists. Recently, he wrote, it's on his blog, a short and accessible, very accessible essay. It's in four parts, still short, titled an essay, What the New Deal Can Teach About Winning a Green New Deal. So, Marty, tell us why you wrote on the lessons of the New Deal. It's known as the 30s New Deal and the Great Depression, but in fact, the New Deal lasted for quite a long time and became more important, actually, in the 50s and 60s.
Well, I think what really led me back to that period was first just being taken by the enormous excitement that the notion of a Green New Deal has generated. And I think, you know, the excitement of that was really giving people a sense of a new way to live, a whole new way to imagine relationships, social, economic, environmental. And I think it really stimulated a lot of people in important political ways.
It's a whole reconstruction, not just of the economy.
Yeah. And I think that one of the ways in which the Green New Deal has rooted in people's minds and has added to its popularity is the fact that it says New Deal in it. And people have a vision of the 30s as a period when we suffered a major crisis, a period when we really needed an enormous transformation of our economy. And the government stepped in and, as it's kind of popularly understood, implemented these transformative policies which solved our crisis and moved us ahead into a new economy that served our needs far better.
And made Roosevelt a beloved national leader for having dealt with the Great Depression and saved us so many children from starvation, with 30% unemployment in the country, with huge numbers of evictions, people on the road.
Oh, definitely. And so, So if you have this period in mind where there was this need for transformative change and government policy comes in and does it, it makes it easier to imagine a Green New Deal where we face another need for another transformative set of policies, and we need a government to lead us. And so this is what's become very important.
And like back then, it calls for a fundamental reconstruction that people actually want.
Yes.
And so we have this idea of the New Deal.
Right.
It gives us
a feeling that these things can be done.
Right.
So for me, you know, it is a little bit far afield, but it's sort of how I think about it. When people in the labor movement got very excited by the teacher strikes, and particularly, say, West Virginia strike, which was a statewide teacher strike, not only for higher teacher salary, but for all education workers, taxes. Knowing about that inspired people in other places. And inspiration is one thing. But the question is, how did they do that strike? How did they organize statewide? How did they create leaders in local schools? How did they connect them? How did they decide? That's what becomes very important. And for me, the same thing was true about the New Deal in the Green New Deal. Yes, it was inspiring, but there's things that we need to be learning about the actual experience of the New Deal that can alert us to the kinds of challenges and struggles we're going to face if we're going to get a Green New Deal.
Yeah, let's get into that more deeply, how the New Deal developed and the resistance, the tremendous resistance of capital to do. I'll give a little bit of a summary. Yeah. There is always tremendous resistance from capital, from the business owners. They saw people starving and they thought, oh, it's a local challenge. Let the churches take care of it. That was their response. We're not going to do anything because this lasted for quite a while. In fact, the Great Depression was going on over 10 years, until World War II, and the economy was in bad shape. But people were organizing. That's the point.
Well, yes. And so then, I mean, just to build on what you're saying, the Great Depression went on for 4 years before the movement, which I'll get to in a second, was able to push Roosevelt to some very minor reforms, which are considered, in 1933, his first New Deal. And what's so sobering about that, and why it's important for the movement for a Green New Deal to understand these things, is that in those first 4 years of depression, it was also a time of hard times for capitalists. And even despite that, they were unwilling to endorse policies that would upset the status quo. They remained committed to no federal relief programs, no deficit spending, nothing that would upset kind of the free market that they have. And in this case, where we're talking about a crisis, it's not even at this point a crisis of profitability for capital. So what we really need to be aware of is that we can't expect those with power in this system, this is sort of the first lesson, to say, oh my, I recognize the crisis, let's do something.
Yeah, in fact, the first New Deal, I read your four sections, I'm looking forward to the fifth.
And last.
The first New Deal, after 4 years of Roosevelt in power, spent the actions he took were basically to support business. There was very little support, public relief, for ordinary people, where there was enormous starvation and people on the rails.
Yeah, and I think this is another lesson to learn from in organizing around a Green New Deal, what we can learn from the original deal, which was that it took, and I want to be a little more specific about the organizing, because there are some important lessons there, but it took enormous organizing to force, in the first New Deal, very limited relief programs. People were asking for federally organized relief, money, welfare for people who are unemployed. Roosevelt refused to do it. He set up a system where the federal government would make loans to the states if the states put in some money of their own for relief payments. And most of the states were broke, so very few of them took it up. The people who are unemployed were demanding a jobs program. And Roosevelt was very specific. He said, we're not going to get into the business of employing people. But he agreed for a four-month period, a very temporary period of work, which when he saw was going to be expensive because of the millions of people who needed jobs, he canceled. So one of the first lessons is that first New Deal, which was a response to workers' demands, really didn't meet people's needs. And if the movement had just sort of stopped then, who knows how long people would have suffered. But they continued to build. And let me go back then to what did it take to even get that, and why were they able to build movements that were able to respond to minimal government policies by pushing them further? And here I think is really important is that the organizing that took place early on was, in many ways, thanks to the Communist Party, which organized councils of unemployed. And they had begun doing that in 1929, even before the start of the Great Depression. And what those were sort of block groups of people who were unemployed who would come together to fight for relief at relief offices and to restrict evictions. And what they would do, in some cities there might be 60, 70 unemployed councils who would form together to also form a state unemployed council. And so what began to happen is that workers would go in mass to relief offices if a relief office had turned down someone's application and say, we're not leaving, or we threaten to burn down this building until you give relief to such and such a family. Or if the courts tried to order sheriffs to evict someone, they would go in mass and stop those evictions.
And put the furniture back in the house.
Yep. And what began to happen is that people who felt alone, responsible for their own problems, began to see problems as structural in nature. And what began to happen is as cities and states felt overwhelmed by people certainly saying, we're not going to accept the laws or the institutions as valid given what's happening, they began to put pressure on the federal government. So in a sense, the movement was able to kind of press local levels of power up on national powers. At the same time, because the party was a national organization and the councils of unemployed were national, they were organizing national movements for a national unemployment system, for a national job creation system, for a national relief system. And what they would do is not just fly delegates to Washington, D.C., but they would do caravans where they would speak in different cities about the need for programs, which built the unemployed councils and then built a movement in support of those programs. And even on the very first day of Roosevelt's inauguration, they were there with national demonstrations for an unemployed system.
So this was in 1936.
This was in 1933 on his first inauguration.
Really?
Yep.
Wow.
So what was happening is that the Roosevelt administration, which in its early days actually was cutting spending, was seeing that governors and state officials were saying, we're on the verge of revolution in our cities. Our police are being disregarded. Our courts are being disregarded. Our welfare office, we don't have resources. You need to do something. And it was that kind of public pressure that led to the first New Deal, which, as you said, Bill, was initially largely supporting business with some very modest and unacceptable minimal offers to relief and unemployment.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour, talking to Martin Art Landsberg, who has written a lot of books and directed the political economy program at Lewis and Clark College for a long time, has lots of wonderful students who are now writing. I'm sure you're proud of that, Marty. he wrote recently a piece that he published on his blog, and it's an enormous treasury of economic thought. The most recent piece is the What the New Deal Can Teach Us About Winning a Green New Deal. So, Marty, we talked about the very hesitant approach of the Roosevelt machine, even after they were elected by the people to do something and promised to do something, but they didn't want to do something,
right.
And the Congress was absolutely unwilling to do something, and the capitalists thought, things will get better. We're still making money or whatever.
Right.
At least we are. We've laid off a lot of workers.
Yeah.
And really nothing was done in the first, certainly no public relief, very, very little public relief, maybe reached 2% of the people.
Yeah. I think about 2/3 of the people without jobs were not eligible for relief. State relief was even very minimal. Often it was just scripts for basic food, nothing for housing or other necessities.
And those are the people with jobs, actually. But, of course, they were sometimes working 10 hours a week because these companies were failing.
So one of the questions, one of the things that becomes interesting when you're building a movement, they're choices. And there were other groups of unemployed who said, let's do self-help work and let's not organize resistance. And there were other groups who said, well, let's try and lobby the legislature, but let's not do direct organizing. And I think what was so powerful about that movement and an important lesson for those trying to organize and think about a Green New Deal is that the kind of organizing that went on provided a means for people to come together in self-defense locally to transform how they understood the causes of the problem and created a context for them to be connected as part of a national movement where they could see that national policies could help them, but that what they were doing was also contributing to building weight for a national change. It wasn't just only local, it wasn't only national, but it was a kind of a transformative organizing. And what it did is also produce a lot of people with the capacity to be incredible organizers. And that becomes a key in some ways to how the movement was able to respond to Roosevelt's minimal offerings in his first New Deal. Because the success of that unemployed organizing spread to other groups. So you began to get the Socialist Party, you began to get groups that were organized that were followers of A.J. Mustey, who was a minister, pacifist, labor activist, who spread around, and they were now making this movement nationally. But what happened then is when Roosevelt's minimal effort at reform, at relief, created more people on relief, the left group started organizing workers, people on relief, saying, we want more relief. We want less intrusive financial inspections. We want higher pay.
You mean the workers and the recipients.
The recipients and the workers on relief programs joined together in what was called relief leagues.
Yeah.
And they were beginning to say, look, this is unacceptable. We need a better system. And as the economy began to recover from 25% unemployment down to, say, 15% unemployment by 1934, labor movements began to grow. And who were some of the leading activists were people who came out of the unemployed organizing, who had experience and who understood what it meant. And they began to power a labor resurgence, which are highlighted by enormous auto strike in Toledo, Ohio, enormous trucking strike led by a Trotskyist local of the Teamsters in 34, and what turned out to be a general strike in San Francisco as part of the longshore. And so what happened then, and at the same time, movements were growing, demanding a real Social Security Act. And so what happened is Roosevelt, who thought that his first New Deal might satisfy, was now being faced with not only continued unemployed organizing demanding relief and jobs, relief workers organizing demanding improvement and relief, and a labor movement that was now demanding unions, and in fact, all of those movements—
wages, jobs, shorter hours, minimum wage, unemployment insurance.
Yeah, and also showing that when you launch a general strike, you're saying the rules are no longer going to be the rules. That it's essentially saying workers are going to be establishing and determining what power looks like. And the same with unemployed organizing and relief organizing who are engaging in strikes, disregarding laws, challenging the police and the courts. And it was this kind of pressure that led Roosevelt, with his advisor saying to him, something has to be done in 35 to launch what was called the Second New Deal.
Or we're going to have a revolution in this country.
This is the danger.
Yes.
So the question is then, from a Green New Deal point of view, how do you prepare people right now to understand how real significant change unfolds?
Yes, she got them for sale. Got the money than the red hot. Yes, she got them for sale. I got a good such a long and tall. She sleeps in the kitchen with a piece in the hall. Got the money than the red hot. Yes, she got them for sale, I mean. Yes, she got them for sale, yeah. Got the money than the red hot. Yes, she got them for sale. Got the money than the red hot. Yes, she got them for sale. She got 2 foot nickel, got 4 foot dime. Say more, but there ain't none of mine. Hot the mother than the red hot. Yes, she got on a sale, I mean. Yes, she got on a sale, yes, yes.